Alex was born in France and is a lawyer, or a barrister, as they say in Europe, by profession. He, part of his work, he did both in France, but also in Finland, a number of years, almost two decades in Finland. And when while he was in Finland, one of the things that he taught specifically on, or that he worked in, was in the whole area of the European integration, essentially the foundation of the European Union. How did that come to be? And he was asked to lecture in the universities on these topics as an expert. And what he found when he was presenting about the foundations of the European Union is that his students in the courses were much more interested in the individuals and the character of the founders of the European Union than they were around the regulations of the European Union and the policies and how it all came to be. Because the individuals who founded the European Union were men and women of great character, of greatness. They had great aspirations. They were wonderful examples of leadership. And so he found that the students would love to hear more and more about these great characters of history. And that led to the creation and to this sense of being drawn into looking at what is virtuous leadership? What does it mean to be a leader with character? I met Alex about 6 years ago, thanks to a mutual friend who is in the audience tonight, Cecil. And we've collaborated together on a number of aspects with CCO's work and a number of other projects. So it's a great pleasure to have him here. One day, he was in New York City, Phoenix, and he came to Ottawa specifically for this event and a few other meetings today. So we're really privileged to have him. So without further ado, I just want to present Alex Savard.
Thank you, Jeff. Yeah, I'm very honored to be with you today, students. As you say, that Jeff said a few minutes ago, I was a lawyer for many years in Paris, in Strasbourg, in Helsinki. I spent 27 years in France. I spent 18 years in Finland, and now I've been living 10 years in Russia, Moscow. I come from a very, very multicultural background, Russian, French, Georgian. I've lived in very different countries. I met very different people. I was a lawyer. The truth is that it's because of you, because of young students, that I quit with law and I began to do what I am doing, what I've been doing during the last 15 years. So I like very much to meet with students, because my students came to me at Helsinki University when I was speaking about giving a course on history of European integration and speaking a lot about the founders of European Union: Robert Schuman, Alcide De Gasperi, Konrad Adenauer, Jean Monnet. These were great people. I'm not a fan of European Union. I repeat, I'm not a fan. I'm a fan of the founders of European Union. It's a very different thing. So the students brought me to the idea that I had to quit with law and I had to dedicate my life to what I'm doing now, what I've been doing during the last 15 years or 20 years. What I've been doing, what I have been thinking a lot about, what's true leadership, because fundamentally the question the students were asking me were more or less, what do I have to do to become a man like Robert Schuman, Alcide De Gasperi, Konrad Adenauer? These people were people with values, with virtues, with character, with very concrete ideas. They were movers and shakers. And my students were asking me, how do we become people like this? At that time, I understood that the university does not really educate people. You know, the word education comes from the Latin educare, which comes from another Latin word, educere, which means to bring out greatness in people. To educate people is to bring out the greatness in them. It's not about instilling information. University was not really doing that job, and that's why my students were asking me, in one way or another, they were asking me to educate them. So I had to think a lot about those things, and then I quit with law. I came back to the good books. I had education in philosophy, not only in law, so it was not too complicated for me. And I wrote that book during 3 years, Virtuous Leadership, which was published in the United States in 2007, 10 years ago, and it was translated into 20 languages, which means that the things we're speaking about today are not, it's not religion, it's not ideology. We were speaking about things that are related to the human nature, things that people understand all over the world. A year ago, he was teaching 50 Muslims in South Russia, in Nalchik, at the border with Georgia. They understand perfectly the things we're going to speak about today. I haven't usually have a secular audience, secular people who have little relation with religion, and they understand perfectly also what we are speaking about. I know that the majority of you here are Christians, like I am, so I will allow myself also to make some spiritual additions in order to that you will feel that you have the whole picture of the thing. You have the whole picture of what virtuous leadership is about. So I came very quickly to the conclusion that leadership is about achieving greatness by bringing out the greatness in others. This is the first thing. It took me a little bit of time. Why? Because we are under this culture of management in the world. People think that management, leadership are more or less the same thing, when in fact, these are very different sides. Management is about moving people forward. Management is about moving things forward. It's about achieving goals. You know, a manager is someone who set high goals and go for those goals, and he's happy when he gets things done. Yeah, manager is happy when he gets things done. This is a job. Know how to get things done. We need managers, and we have millions of managers all over the world, but we don't have many leaders. We have a real crisis of leadership. Why? Because leadership is much more complicated. Leadership is about moving people forward. You need to love people, first of all. You need to love people more than things in order to be a real leader. The priority of leadership is human beings. It's about achieving greatness by bringing out the greatness in the others. So there are two things immediately that you perceive in leadership. This idea of greatness, a vision of greatness, and a vision of service. Because you want to achieve greatness by bringing out the greatness in the others, which means that you want to serve the others. And from the very beginning, I want to say one thing, which is very important, because I've seen so many people that don't understand really what's true greatness. What is true greatness? Very important thing. True greatness, what's that? True greatness is not about being a tower. It's not about building an empire, a business empire or a military empire all over the world. This is not greatness. The true greatness can be only human, spiritual. It's about the transformation of people. It's about moving forward the people that you're serving. So you need to think about this all the time. What is the true greatness I want to achieve? And the most important greatness for you, it's you, yourself. What kind of human being you're becoming? Am I becoming a great person? Am I discovering my talents? Am I multiplying my talents? Am I serving humanity with my talents? Am I contributing to the common good of humanity with my talents? Am I trying to overcome the limitations of my personality? Am I becoming a great person? Am I becoming a saint for those who are Christians around us? This is the true, this is the unique greatness that is interesting. A tower, an empire, a big business. It's not serious. It's not serious. This is nothing compared to spiritual greatness, which is the only true greatness we need to speak about. Am I helping people I'm serving to become great people? If you're parents, am I helping my children to become real individuals, people with character, with value, with character, with energy, with courage, with prudence, with justice, with self-mastery, with magnanimity, with humility? Am I doing this or not? And am I becoming this kind of person doing those things? This is what greatness is about. The very important businessmen we've seen in the history of humanity were leaders, because the priority for them were human beings. And helping their people, their employees, to become great people, what they've done, they have achieved an incredible management, because they understood that first they need to serve people. The people are those who are creative. They're those that have imagination. There is a very famous French businessman. He passed away 2 years ago. François Michelin. He was the CEO of Michelin Group, the tire industry, for 55 years. When I went to see him in central France some years ago, He told me, Alex, I have to tell you the story of my grandfather. My grandfather was an incredible guy. His name was Edward. He created the company in the end of the 19th century. He was making tires. One day, a young man came to the company, knocked at the door, said, my name is Marius Mignol. I want to work for you. I have passion for the tires. The chief of staff listened to him. He asked him, do you have degrees? No, I left school when I was 15. So what can you do? I've been working for a few years in a printing department of a company not far away from here. So I know about printing. Good. I hire you. I send you to the printing department of Michelin. And he sent him to the printing department of the company. When Edward Michelin heard about that story, he went to see his chief of staff and he told him, you're an idiot. You don't know that guy. And you send him to the printing department where there is nothing creative to be done. You know nothing about him. Remember always one thing. You need to break the stone in order to discover the diamond that is hidden inside. Break the guy. Send him to the international commercial department. Imagine the chief of staff. Well, he sent him to the international commercial department. Here we have Marius Mignol buying stuff for the tires on the international markets without mathematics. But Marius was not an idiot. Because he had no mathematics, he left school when he was 15, he created a very simple ruler to convert the currencies quickly. One day, Edward Michelin saw on the table of Mignol that little ruler. He took it in his hands and he said, but this guy is a genius. In a few seconds, Edward Michelin understood that this man, without mathematics, having left school at 15 years old, capable of inventing such stuff, is seriously not an idiot. And he said, geniuses don't work in commercial departments. Sorry for those who work in commercial departments. And he sent him where? To the research department. At the time, the problem was very simple. Cars were going faster and faster every day, but the tire was still the same, the traditional one. And they were hitting very much at high speed, and it was very dangerous for the clients, for those who were driving cars. And during decades, the best students of Ecole Polytechnique in Paris, who were working for Michelin, tried to understand what's happening at high speed, why the tire gets hot so much. How do we stop that process of heating of tires at high speed? They didn't get it. To put the story short, after a few years of investigation and work, Marius Mignol invented the radial tire that changed the industry of tires all over the world and made company Michelin the number one in its field in the world. Remember one thing. You need to break the stone in order to discover the diamond that is hidden inside. To think like this, which is leadership thinking, you need to love people. People need to be a priority for you. He was a great manager, obviously. His company became the number one in the world. But how he achieved this? Through leadership, by helping his people becoming real people. Not fake, by loving them, by trying to discover the diamond hidden in each of them. He achieved greatness, Edward, by bringing out the greatness in the others. Here you have a great example of an incredible manager who was a magnificent leader, who achieved leadership, and at the same time he achieved management at the highest level. So there is no contradiction. There is no contradiction. Do you have many businessmen, Darwin Smith at Kimberly-Clark in the 1980s, beginning of the 1980s, was a great leader. And his company became the number one in his time in the world in the consumer paper industry because he was a leader. Herb Kelleher, Southwest Airlines, the same. They were incredible people. They loved human beings. They think people are a priority. And they achieved through this an incredible management. They are recognized as being the best most powerful businessman in the history of humanity after the Second World War. So there is no contradiction at all. It's just a way of being, a way of thinking. Leadership is not about things, it's about people. It's a way of being. It's not a function. Many people without any formal power are leaders, because this is what they do. They educate the others. They achieve greatness by bringing out the greatness in others. But I was asked today very much to help you discover your mission in life. Why? The virtue that brings greatness to people is the virtue of magnanimity. Magnanimity is a striving of the spirit, of the heart, of the mind, of the will towards great things. It is awareness of your dignity as a human being. Your awareness that you are spiritual beings, you are not vegetables, you are not chimpanzees, you are not a thing, you have a spirit. And you're aware of that spirit. You have a free will, you have responsibility, you have a conscience, and you're proud of that. And at the same time, if you're Christians, you know you are sons and daughters of God. This awareness, this affirmation of your personal dignity is the beginning of magnanimity. Aristotle tells us that a magnanimous man, a magnanimous woman, is a man or woman who considers himself worthy of great things. So everything begins with this, worthiness. Who am I? Who am I? Do I have a vision of what I am? A son of God, a daughter of God, a spiritual being, a free individual? And do I affirm this reality in deeds? Do I dream? Do I transform my dreams into action, into missions? Here is the keywords. Magnanimity is not just about dreaming. It's about transforming dreams into action. It's a very complicated virtue, because it's the virtue of people that are contemplative and active at the same time. It's the virtue of people that are philosophers and doers at the same time. It's not easy. Why? Because all of us, we have a specific temperament, the biological temperament that pushes you in one direction or another, either towards contemplation or towards action. Choleric people are driven towards action immediately because they achieve self-fulfillment in action necessarily, because they are biologically like this. Melancholic people, it's more the contemplative side. They are idealistically minded, the idea, the beauty, the artist. They achieve self-realization through contemplation. And magnanimity is here to tell us, guys, you have a biological direction for your life. You have to know it. But you have to compensate. If you are the choleric type who needs action all the time, you need to be capable of making stops in your life and contemplating more, thinking more, praying more. Don't give in blind activeness, activism, workaholism. That will kill you. But this is a natural temptation for you. If you are on the contemplative side, biologically speaking, because you're melancholic, think, I have no problem to pray, to think, to contemplate, but I have problems with action. I have to develop the virtue of audacity, boldness. This will compensate this difficulty that I have to get out of myself. Melancholic people have a tendency to be self-absorbed, absorbed by their thoughts, by their emotions, by their passions, absorbed by their ideas. And they have difficulty to get at some of themselves, to transform their dreams into action. They have dreams. They dream a lot. They are dreamers. But action is not easy for them. So you have to get to know yourself very well to develop magnanimity, to know what's my temptation. For the choleric, the temptation is workaholism. For the melancholic, the temptation is self-absorption. If you know those things, you know where the starting point for you guys. And you begin with that. And you see very quickly what's the virtue that's going to challenge you all your life. Because your biological status, your biological structure will be here until the very last day of your life. You cannot get rid of your biology. It's a gift of God, your biology. It's good that we are all different. Because if we're all different, then it's not boring to live in this world. To transform dreams into missions. But then people like you, people, young people in general, want to know, what's my mission in life? How do I discover my mission? Because the mission is a big part of the virtue of magnanimity. The mission comes out from a dream. But a dream that is transformed into action, a dream that has no concrete results, is not a magnanimous dream. You have dreamers who dream in order to enjoy the dream, not in order to do or to implement the dream. These are small people. These are not magnanimous people. The magnanimous one is the one who dreams and immediately think about how can I transform this into a reality? How can I transform a dream into a mission? That's why it's important for us to think about what's our mission in life. When you're very young, like you are all very young, it's not easy. But you have to begin to think about the process of discovering your mission. You know, I live in Moscow, and very often there are very young people who come to me after a presentation on virtuous leadership. Alex, what's my mission in life? How old are you? 17. Well, well, I have no idea. You don't even know yourself. You've not tried many things in life. You don't know your strength. You don't know who you are. Have you tried to know who you are? What are your strengths? Where do you come from? A mission is not a whim. This is the first mistake that we can do, is to think, I would like to do this. This is a bad start. This is a whim. A mission is not what you want to do. A mission is the result, first of all, of self-knowledge. Who am I? Where do I come from? In which country were I born? Who are my grandparents? Where do they come from? What is their story? My parents, who are they? Where do they come from? What is their story? What are the personal gifts I have received? What is my temperament biological? Who am I? What is my story? Do I have a story to tell? And you have to begin with this, an investigation. Many people live in you because you are not individuals. You are persons. And because you're persons, you're interactive, you are receiving and giving, but you've received a lot. You have to think about, what are those great things that I have received? You need to investigate. It's not easy, but you need to make an investigation. It may take years for you to investigate those things, to get to know yourself well. Many people live in you, and you have to be conscious of that. And you've received a lot. And the many things you've received must create in you a sense of gratitude. Magnanimity comes out as gratitude, first of all. I have received all those great things. This is what I am. All those people around give me this, that, that. This grandfather gave me this. This grandmother gave me that. My mother gave me this. This friend gave me this. I have received a lot of stuff. All these people live in me in a way or another. I'm not just myself. I am not alone. I'm not alone. I have received a lot of stuff. Then you make the investigation and you begin to understand little by little all the great things that you have received. You contemplate them. You study them. And you begin to write your story. And you have to begin to write. And you have to come back to your writings very often, at least once a year, to complement what you've written, to correct what you've written, to enter more deeply in what you've written. And little by little, you will see, you will understand who you are. It's not an easy stuff. But people who do this always thank me very much. At the beginning, they don't understand the meaning of all that. I teach people like you, young students. At the beginning, they say, well, I have to work on that. I say, yes, you have to work on that. Do it. I cannot do the job for you. And they write 2, 3, 4 pages. And in the end, all of them write, now I understand why this was useful. They begin to understand themselves better. They begin to understand their talents, their responsibility, the great things they've received. You feel the beginning of a sense of gratitude towards God, towards life, to your parents, grandparents, friends. And they begin to understand more or less who they are. A mission is not a whim. It has to do with self-knowledge. You don't do what you want to do. You do what you are. You do things according to what you are, according to the very specific talents that you have received. And then, after you have a certain level of self-knowledge, you see in society certain things that you would like to improve. You feel a certain challenge somewhere, and you feel desire to go for that with passion and with persistence. So you have to get a strong knowledge of yourself and at the same time a strong knowledge of what's happening around. A strong knowledge of self and a strong knowledge of the world in which you live. And you put those two things together and little by little you begin to see your mission. It's not a whim. There is a problem somewhere and you are someone with specific gifts, specific talents, a specific history. And you begin to understand, well, this could be my mission. I've known quite well a Russian guy called Alexander Solzhenitsyn. You heard about him? Yeah. Solzhenitsyn was a guy who was in a gulag, in a concentration camp in North Kazakhstan in the 40s, in the end of the 40s, beginning of the 50s. He was writing books in his head. Why in his head? Because he had no paper and he had no pen. And he had not the right to have them in a camp. So he wrote these books in his head. And he has some friends there in the gulag with him. And he was used to tell them what he had written. And those guys around him told him, Sanya. Sanya is one of the multiple diminutive of Alexander in Russian. Sanya, you write. You're a writer. You have a real talent for that. So Solzhenitsyn, with the feedback from his friends, understood that he has a talent for writing, that he writes well. At the same time, he understood the problem. There are millions of people dying here, and no one is telling their story. And in this deep evil, there are great people. And he thought, what's my mission? I have to become the memory. Fantastic. Few words. I had to become the memory of these people. I have to be the memory of 50 million people. Nobody has written their story. I have to write it. This is important for the future of Russia. A country without memory is a dead country. And he thought, I have not the right to die until I've not written that story. He didn't die. He died, he was almost 90 years old. in 2007. But they tried to destroy him. They tried to kill him. He had a cancer. He was dying, and he survived because he knew, I cannot die. I am the memory of these people. This is my mission. I am a writer, and there is a problem. I will write that memory. I will picture that memory until the very last day of my life. And he wrote, and he spent his days writing, and he wrote here during years until he got a ban after he was freed from the gulag. Incredible people. Incredible because they have a very strong self-knowledge and they know their talent. At the same time, they know a problem and they want to face that problem with courage, audacity, magnanimity. And they go forward until the very last day of their lives. Your mission becomes your criterion, I would say, decision-making criterion for your life. It's a very important thing, a decision-making criteria. You have a foundation for making decisions. I had another friend who was also very famous. His name was Jérôme Lejeune. Jérôme Lejeune died the day of Easter 1994. Who was he? He was a French geneticist who discovered the causes of Down syndrome, trisomy 21. He was a brilliant guy. When he was 34 years old in France, we created the chair of fundamental genetics for him. 34 years old. He was brilliant. He was a genius. He discovered something incredible. Why? What happens to those people who were born like this with Down syndrome? What's the cause of that? He was receiving in San Francisco the prize, John Allen Prize of genetics, of human genetics, the top prize in that field. He went to San Francisco in 1969 to make his speech when he was receiving the prize. People wanted him to receive the biggest prize, which is the Nobel Prize of genetics, of medicine. So everybody looked at him. People looked for his speech. What was he going to say? The day before he spoke, he met all the many American doctors, medical doctors who were around, and geneticists and scientists. And he was horrified. Because in a way or another, they were telling him, thanks, Jérôme, that you discovered the cause of trisomy 21, Down syndrome. Now we can kill those babies before they're born. Because now we know how to identify them and know what's happening there. Well, Jérôme had to make a choice. I tell him the truth or I lie. If I tell him the truth, I'm crucified forever. If I lie, I am a god forever on earth. Not in heaven, on earth. Well, he tell him the truth, the scientific truth, to the scientists that science, genetics, has demonstrated that human beings are fully human beings at the very moment of conception. If not, they will never become human beings. Because genetics demonstrates that nothing happens serious, substantial, after fertilization of the ovum. So it is a human being now, but will never become. That abortion is a crime against humanity. This guy understood his mission in life at that very moment. First of all, he lost his Nobel Prize in a few seconds. He was crucified by the media. He lost all the money they were giving him for his research. He knew the choice he was doing. But out of that came a mission to speak the scientific truth to the whole world. Not the moral truth. The scientific truth about what is a human being from a scientific point of view. To speak the scientific truth all my life. Every time I can do this, I will do that. And of course, to speak about the moral truth that results from that scientific truth. To speak the scientific truth. This was his mission. He was a scientist. He knew the truth. He spoke very well. He was a phlegmatic personality, so he was like many scientists. So very cool, dispassionate, rational, clear. He did this during years. And he died the day of Easter. And on his tomb, it's written Nika. In Greek, it means victory. And when the Pope John Paul II arrived to France in 1996, the first thing he did was to take a car and to go to see Nika, his friend, Jerome. Mother Teresa, she had a mission. She said, I wanted to be a mother for millions of people who are dying without hope, without love, who have been living like animals. I want them to die like angels. She didn't want to build a hospital. No, she didn't want. She knew clearly what her mission was about. I wanted to be a mother. And when 20 years after she built her institution in 1956, many people in her surroundings told her, if you want to be efficient, we'd better use decision-making criteria that are proper to NGOs. And we're ready to give, and many people were ready to give them, to give her billions of dollars for that. She said, this is not our mission. We are not nurses. We're not here to help those people, to cure these people. This is not our mission. We are here to be mothers when they are dying. We are not a hospital. She knew perfectly what her mission was. No doubt, no 1 second of doubt. And she said, we don't need your billions of dollars. We are not nurses. And many people left her. She knew what her mission was. She was very clear about that. I wanted to be a memory. I wanted to speak the scientific truth. I wanted to be a mother. These people knew exactly what their life is about. And all of us, each one of us, we have to think about that. What's our life about? What's our talent? What's the problem we want to face in society, with conviction, hope, persistence, and passion, according to what we are, according to our personal history, according to our personal talents. And little by little, we write down our mission, we try to be precise. We know we can make mistakes, no problem. With time, we will correct those mistakes when we will get more self-knowledge. And you can begin at your age. Even if it's not the last point of your mission, already now, you can have a certain vision in which direction you're going. You can begin to study that. Who am I? Where I come from? What's the problem? What is the thing I want to dedicate my life to? You follow me. It's not easy. A vocation is not the same thing as a mission. A vocation is God's call from eternity. It's the way God wants you to be. It's about being. It's not about doing something. People that have a religious mind, people that pray, quite easily understand what their vocation is about. It's a result of a personal contact with Christ, with God. People can understand what their vocation is about. But a mission requires a lot of thoughts, a lot of investigation, because it's a very human thing. I'm not speaking about the mission of King David, of Moses, of Abraham. I'm speaking about the mission you and I can have. God, of course, is involved in our mission because God is involved in everything that interests us. So he will support us with his grace, obviously. But he wants you to think. He wants you to have a full freedom in the choice of your mission in life. Do you have a lot of people that have a sense of vocation, but they don't have a sense of mission? They have a sense of vocation because they are deeply religious people, but they have no sense of mission because they are not magnanimous. And you have people that are magnanimous and they have a sense of mission, but they don't have much sense of vocation because there is no deep contact with God in their lives. But there is magnanimity. Magnanimity is a human virtue, which means that many people can be magnanimous without being Christians. Because it's a human virtue, it's a universal virtue. You follow me? So it's not easy to discover your mission. It's much more complicated than to discover your vocation. But at the same time, you have much more freedom of choice when you're looking for a mission. When a vocation, you better not make mistakes. Because it's God's plan for you from eternity. So better not make a mistake. You follow me. But a mission, God wants you to investigate and to try to think what is the thing you have to do, what has to be your contribution to humanity. There is a lot of freedom there. A lot of freedom. But at the same time, there must be a lot of thoughts, a lot of work. You have to write your story. You have to come back to your story. You have to begin to write your personal mission statement, and you have to come back to it. You have to get more precise every day about that. And then you discover little by little what could be, what should be, in the end of the day, your mission on earth. What is this thing that you're going to leave on this earth when you die, after you've died? Magnanimity is the virtue of contemplative souls that are at the same time doers. So a dream is not enough to be magnanimous. You have to transform the dream into a mission. And you have to carry that mission with intensity till the very last day of your life. Your mission can evolve, I repeat, can be more precise the more you get to know yourself well. No problem. The important thing is that you think about it. You want to do things, not whims, things that have to do with you, with who you are. Self-knowledge and action. This is what magnanimity is about. It's a complicated virtue, but it's beautiful stuff. This is what greatness is about. A last word about something quite important for you, I want to say. It's what's the relation between magnanimity and humility? I have to speak about this quickly because many Christians have been brought up in humility, but they never heard about magnanimity. They don't even know how to pronounce the word magnanimity. And they have to hear this from a French man who speaks quite bad English. Once I was giving a talk to the top soldier of the U.S. Army, the U.S. War College in Carlisle. And there were about 400 senior officers, future generals of the U.S. Army. And one came to me after a talk of 1 hour. Alex, the stuff of magnanimity was quite good. Another one came and spoke about magnetism. They've never heard about these words. But with humility, no problem. Everybody knows how to pronounce this word. So the problem is that in the end of the day, humility is what? Humility is the habit of living in the truth. That's what humility is about. The habit of living in the truth about yourself. You have to know your strength and your weaknesses. If you know only your weaknesses, you're not humble, you're pusillanimous, you're small. A truly humble person is a person who knows his weaknesses and at the same time knows his strengths, talents, and gifts. And he's aware of that and affirm those gifts in practice. So if you want to be sure that you're magnanimous and humble at the same time, you need first for magnanimity to be aware of your talents and look for your talents and try to discover them and try to multiply them and put them at the service of the community. And second, you must never forget, if you want to be humble, that those gifts are gifts. They were given to you. They are not the result of your personal activity. And many young people forget that. They feel their strength. They feel their energy. They feel their passions. and they build a tower. They build a tower, but there is no foundation. There is no foundation because there is no humility. They don't know where this comes from. They think it's the products of me, the products of my personal activity. I'm a great star. I'm a great singer. I'm a great movie maker. I'm a great whatever it is, sportsman. And at the end of the day, they are aware of their talents, but they are not aware of the origin of those talents. And there is no magnanimity there. There is megalomania. There is pride. And one day comes when everything collapses. You follow me? So you need to be fully aware of your gifts. And at the same time, you need to be fully aware that those gifts are gifts from God, from nature, and that you're responsible for those gifts. And if you have this awareness, everything will be all right. You need to be able to speak about your gifts with naturalness, without false modesty, with naturalness. If not, there is no magnanimity there. But at the same time, I need to be fully aware that these are gifts. They come from God. These are talents that God has given to you for something. They are not yours. Eric Liddell was used to say, the famous Scottish runner who won the gold medal in Paris at the Olympic Games in 1928, God made me fast. Four words to explain a deep philosophical truth. And I finish here. I'm fast, but this comes from God. I'm fast, magnanimity. This comes from God, humility. Remember those words, they're fantastic. They are exactly the heart of our topic today. You have great things to do. You can do great things because you have received a lot and you have to investigate that. But remember always, you have received this. It's not the product of your personal activity. It's not the product of your personal energy. These are gifts. And you have to build on the foundation of those gifts. This is what greatness is about. Thank you.